Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, June 7th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered in my, in my 48 years of doing therapy, and through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, these tools are available absolutely free on the internet at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also download an app from the App Store of your choice by simply typing in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It also contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often for a variety of reasons, beginning with the fact that we believe it's highly likely it'll improve the quality of your life if you actually download those tools and apply them in your life. Other reasons include, but are not limited to, the fact that it frequently stimulates people to have comments or questions or answers or testimonials. And if you're willing to call and share those with us, it always makes it easier for us to live into our intention with this work. Our intention with this work is to be of service. And you can call in at 563-999-3581. That's 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I will turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. And I'd like to remind people that I'm willing to have you do that even if I'm in the middle of a monologue or presenting something from the Way of Mastery, which we've been doing since the beginning of January. Also like to remind people that today's a Tuesday. That means there'll be a support group offered again tonight, absolutely free, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. All the information you would need to join us there is available at mindshiftersacademy.org website. And there is a separate login information page for Tuesday and Thursday. We offer groups on both days of the week. And we'd appreciate it if you would either join us and or pass the information along to somebody you think that might be interested in joining us for that support group. So we have plenty of time left for comments, questions, answers, testimonials. Our call-in number again is 563-999-3581. On this relatively sunny Tuesday here outside of Chicago. And what we've been doing since January 10th, as I mentioned, is the Way of Mastery. Reading it slowly, commenting on it, rereading each chapter at least twice, except for the meditation and number and chapter lesson 11. And approaching this as though if we work slowly and carefully and softly and gently and with fun and with openness and with questioning, we might uncover a set of tools, just like an archaeologist might uncover in the dirt or the sands or even underneath a rock some gem or some fossil or some wisdom held in a scroll from ancient times. And it's been my experience with this book, The Way of Mastery, that that's exactly what happens. As I keep coming back to it and read through it and let it sink in and have me soften and question and play with the exercises when I feel called to, and yesterday we began reading from lesson 13, the title of which is You Are Unlimited Spirit. And it suggested an exercise to expand our awareness. And that exercise is that we keep coming back to this thought, and we choose to value this thought for a while and see what it resonates within us. And the thought is this: I am not what I have perceived myself to be. I am unlimited, pure spirit, and everything is available to me. Therefore, in this moment, I choose to open access to other dimensions of experience, so that I might call this moment to me in a different way. And it suggests that if you choose to experiment with that thought, that concept, that pebble, that as those words are spoken, as you speak those words, just notice what comes into your mind. Impressions, images, thoughts, physical sensations, memories. And it encourages us in this book to tune into a different level of experience than the very gross, the very rough, the very apparent physical sensations that we get from the five senses and from our surface level of thought, the conscious logical thought that's always chattering in our minds with words and impressions and echoes of the past. And what this work is calling us to on a regular basis is to ask to be shown something beyond what our conscious logical mind keeps offering up, something beyond the obvious thoughts, impressions, and memories that come up. Much like David E. Martin in his book, Lizards Eat Butterflies, hypothesizes that since there's a cranial nerve for each of the five senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, and we have 12 cranial nerves, it's entirely possible that we are intended to be able to sense, tap into, and read other energies, other sources of input than just the five senses. And with practice, with asking to be shown, with experimentation, with a process that might be called releasing our attachment to the five senses, releasing my attachment to the thoughts that contain judgment, and putting a higher value on questioning and observing and asking to be taught, I might learn, I might develop, I might grow into abilities that have only been hinted at by ascended masters and saints and even science fiction fantasies and great spiritual traditions. And that the essence of this work is to say that each and every person who is alive, who is in the body, who has consciousness, has access to that and more. The text goes on from where we left off yesterday, page 157. It says, if you choose to do this work, you will discover that you can trust your unlimited spirit. And as you sit in your car, looking at the one behind the wheel of an automobile next to you, and you allow yourself to relax and notice what is around the edge as it touches your consciousness, you will realize that this means that minds are not separate from one another. And if their mind is touching yours, your mind is touching theirs. And you're free to send them love. You are free to notice what you pick up from another. And without even opening the physical mouth, you can send the answer of wisdom that they are seeking. Imagine being able to go to your grocery store and push your little metal carts down the aisle so that you can fill it with the boxes of what appears to be fresh food. And at the same time, notice the thought waves of those around you. Imagine beginning to pick up what is going on in their drama, in their story, in their life, and actually being able to telepathically communicate to them the answers to their dilemmas. Would that not feel like a greater degree of freedom than what you're accustomed to? The way of transformation absolutely requires that you be committed to living differently. For is not transformation a change from the status quo? How can you experience transformation if you do not use time to think and be differently? Crying out to me, to Yeshua, or any of the spirits, or ascended masters, or any outside source that you think of will not do it. Reading 1,000 holy books will not do it. One thing and one thing only will bring you into the transformation that you have sought. The willingness to abide where you are differently. And you know, this seems like such just absolute dribble and common sense that most people laugh this off. And yet, every time I've paid money or been blessed with a free ticket to some great motivational speaker, whether they're Brian Tracy or Bob Proctor or Wayne Dyer or Ram Dass, or no matter who I go see who's elevated in the minds of people that are seekers, whether they're motivational speakers for, you know, financial abundance or spiritual abundance, they all say, listen, you've got to start doing something differently. if you keep doing the same thing you've always done, you're going to get the same kind of results you've always gotten. And so many people, I remember one of the first times I was introduced to Dr. Michael Rice, and he talked about doing 5 worksheets a day for 40 days to transform your life. And there would be all kinds of comments from people in the audience at the time and in discussions afterwards to say, that's ridiculous. I don't have time for that. And Michael Rice would come back and say, well, if you recognize that this will change your life for the better, dramatically, permanently, what else is there to do? And if you don't have time to, you know, in one of the talks he gave, you would talk about tithing as a spiritual practice. And people would groan, and he'd be quick to say, listen, we're not talking about money. We're not saying give us or give anybody else 10% of your income. The acronym he uses for this is TIME, time, intelligence, money, and energy. So there are 4 aspects of which I'm going to address and look at where I'm spending my energy in this work. The energy of my time, the energy of my intelligence, the energy of my money, and the energy of the actual physical, emotional, spiritual energy. And if I want to use the power and the leverage of this ancient thought about tithing, I'm going to spend 10% of my time, my intelligence, my money, and my energy and direct it towards those things that feed me, that give me back energy, that give me back increased clarity and give me a sense of fulfillment and gratitude and appreciation. So whether I put that money into a career that I have that I find fulfilling all the way around, not just financially, or I put that time, intelligence, money, and energy into a spiritual group or a religious group or a library that I'm trying to build or whatever it is, when I look at that, and I say, okay, I want to be tithing towards several different areas of my life. One might be financial expenditures, earning money. One might be my personal spiritual growth. One might be my relationships, family and friends. And then if I'm going to tithe in those areas, that means I'm going to spend 10% of my time in a day working for each of those areas. So I'm going to spend at least 2.4 hours in high-intensity work to bring in money to keep body and soul together, as my grandmother would say. I'm going to spend at least 2.4 hours on my spiritual work. I'm going to spend at least 2.4 hours on my family relationships. And whenever Michael would say something like that, and he'd say something that you're going to spend 2.4 hours in prayer and meditation or reading inspirational works or doing your worksheets or whatever, people would say, well, that's ridiculous. I don't have 2.4 hours. I have so much going on in my life. I'm so busy. I can't possibly do that. And Michael's response would be, well, then rearrange your life. In other words, change things, do things differently so that you can start putting your energy, time, intelligence, money, and physical energy into things that will bring you back a reward, into creating a life that is by choice rather than by automatic decision process or by rote or by a sense of compulsion or obligation. And that's essentially what this book is saying to us here. It's saying, look, imagine changing the way you think about yourself and everyone you interact with, even when you're doing something ordinary like going to the grocery store. Imagine as you drive to the store and park your car, before you just jump out, you know, before you just check your grocery list and jump out and head in, you take a moment and you breathe and you remember something like this that says, hey, I'm not just a physical body. I am pure spirit and everything is available to me. In this moment, I choose to open access to other dimensions of experience. So I might call this moment and the experience of it to me in a different way. So I'm going to go into this store and I'm going to see everybody I interact with as another being of brilliance and light. I'm going to see everybody I interact with through that filter that was offered by the mirror theory, which is there in front of me is the love of God in search of self. And when I do something like that, when I change the actual mind energy I'm using from this kind of robotic pastime or process that I've been involved in for so many years, I bring my conscious focus of awareness into the moment, and I watch my thoughts. I'm not going to just let them run at what Guy Finley would call the mechanical level of thought. I'm not going to trudge through another trip to the grocery store like a zombie, getting irritated at people that don't move their cart when I think they should, or spend too much time reading the labels on something that I need to get over there and buy some, you know, black-eyed peas. And why are you just, you know, I'm not going to just be a zombie. I'm not going to blindly go through the day like I've gone through every other day. I'm going to choose differently. I'm going to imagine all minds are joined. I'm going to ask to be shown what's going on in this fellow traveler, this other being of brilliance and light that I'm interacting with. I'm going to train myself to be aware of and trust these more subtle perceptions that are available. And again, here at page 157 in The Way of Mastery, it says, the way of transformation absolutely requires that you be committed to living differently. You don't have to do that, but if you want to be on the way of transformation, you have to do that. You can't keep doing the same thing over and over again and get any different results than you've always gotten. You can choose to just be a zombie. You can choose to just be a little robot of habit. You can choose to just say, well, I do it this way because that's what I've always done. The text reads, for is not transformation a change from the status quo? How can you experience transformation if you do not use time to think and be differently? Crying out to Yeshua or the saints won't do it. Reading 1,000 holy books will not do it. One thing and one thing only will bring you into the transformation that you have sought. That is the willingness to abide where you are differently, right where you are with whatever you have going on. You know, this echoes in my mind Guy Finley saying, I'll give you something to want to manifest, something completely new to manifest. Manifest a way of being happy with whatever you have right now. Be right where you are. This is The Way of Transformation, page 157. The willingness to abide right where you are and do it differently. Don't don't be in a position where you demand everything changes or that you have abundance of coins in the bank or you have the perfect relationship before you decide to change your experience of life. Change your experience of life right now. Abide differently. Think differently. Open yourself to different energies. Open yourself to questioning in each new present moment, to asking to be shown instead of knowing. Realign what you value in life and create a different experience of life. The text goes on and says, begin again with the simple exercise of reminding yourself that in truth you are unlimited spirit and you are abiding in all dimensions. All extraordinary abilities are already inherent in your consciousness. For if they would not, it would mean that the Creator creates with inequality. Your egoic mind might respond, well, you might have been born with that gift, but I don't have it. No. The Creator creates his or her offspring. And that sonship, that community of the offspring of the Creator is made up of equals in spirit. The only difference in the field of time is that it appears that some have accessed and cultivated their inherent abilities more so than have others. It's about awareness. It's not about inequality or equality. It's about focus of consciousness, openness, and awareness. The text goes on and says, you then use this to perceive that another person, another being, another spirit is more special than you. And you use that as a way of proving to yourself your lack of worth, your smallness, or your weakness. You think that perhaps someday, if you only lived the next 100,000 times of lifetimes being a good person, then maybe these abilities will begin to spontaneously show up in you. But there are no accidents, and nothing you see that is being made manifest in the life of anyone has occurred by accident. Everything you see is deliberate. Everything. Therefore, if you would look upon another person and say, oh, well, they can talk to Yeshua, but I could never do that. Stop lying to yourself. Rather, come to see that if this ability of speaking with saints and ascended masters is being made manifest in your field of awareness, it's because you have called it to yourself as a reminder of what is already inherent within you. If another person lays the hands on the body and the forehead of one who is sick, and the one who is sick arises and the disease is no longer present, remember, you have called that experience through that beloved brother or sister. You've called that experience into the field of your consciousness to remind you of the truth of your being. If you are attracted to being a healer, then drop everything else and be committed to begin healing. Think about what that would mean in terms of how we live our lives. And of course, it is not the kind of thing that's going to lead to us being a good factory worker all the time. It's not going to lead to us being good consumers constantly all the time. It will probably lead to a much higher degree of satisfaction, peace, contentment, gratitude, serenity, bliss. But right here, page 158, it says, listen, if you feel attracted to being a healer, then drop everything else that you've been committed to and become committed to healing, to learning to heal, to to healing, to be the presence of love which extends healing. It's pretty deep, radical stuff. This is a call to change the way you live. Beginning in lesson 13, there's a call. This is an invitation. It's not a commandment. It's not a demand. There's no threat. There's just the clear delineation that in order to have a different life, you have to choose differently. The first 12 lessons were all about waking up to the fact that your culture has taught you that you are not a creator. But in truth, beginning in the first lesson on page 5, the suggestion is just let this thought enter your mind. Nothing I experience is caused by anything outside of me. I experience only the effects of my own choice. And as a creator, I create my experience of life in each moment. And then in lesson 2, hey, by the way, you need do nothing, because if you needed to do something, that would mean you don't have freedom to choose. But what they're trying to get us to understand is we have the infinite capacity to choose the focus of our conscious awareness in each moment. And wherever we point that energy of creation, that conscious awareness, we create more of what we're pointing it at. So we're being invited now. In the first 12 lessons, we're just being invited to wake up and understand that we're always creating our experience of life, and just be with that process differently. Watch it differently. Release attachments to judgment. Engage in the process that helps us dismantle judgments and move into allowance, acceptance, and surrender. And then in the 13th lesson in the second book, The Way of Transformation, it says, okay, if we've opened your eyes in the first 12 lessons to the possibility that there's an entirely different way to live and experience life moment to moment that's open to you, now you might want to pay attention to what you've been doing with that creative ability, and you might want to start applying it differently moment to moment, radically transforming how you live your life, letting those exercises that you were doing in the first 12 lessons come to fruition and crystallize into a level of desire that's a little bit more clear, a little bit more focused, and then choose to use your energy day in and day out, moment to moment, differently. Understanding that you have access to energies and intelligence and feedback systems that go beyond your conscious logical thought process and what you can register with your five senses. And if you want a different experience of life, you have to make a commitment to spend your time differently. And it's okay if you don't want a different experience of life. It's okay if you want to go on. They've said that several times in the first 12 lessons. No one in a spiritual realm is going to be upset if you choose to cling to smallness and to anger and to upset and fear. It's not going to disturb them at all. Their peace is solid. It is consistent. It is unshakable because they, entities in the spiritual realm, Holy Spirit, Yeshua, whatever you want to call it, consciousness itself understands it is not distracted by the hallucinations and the illusions of the physical realm. And they said several times in the first 12 lessons, you have free choice. No one will take that away from you. Free will cannot be usurped. So if you want to live your life just the way you've always lived it, go right ahead. If you want something different, if you want a level of connectedness and gratitude and bliss and contentment that goes way beyond anything you've had before, here's one way you might do it. Lesson 13 goes on page 158 under the heading Cultivating Unlimited Consciousness. The text reads, as we enter into these lessons on transformation, you will discover that we begin to speak more directly to you. We will not be, quote, beating about the bush, close quotes. We will not be placating your resistance and your fears and not stroking you for the dramas that you have created that have seemed to separate you from the truth of your beingness. For as we move into the way of transformation, the call is being sent forth from us to you to arise and assume complete responsibility for all that you see, all that you think, and all that you choose. Rest assured, if you hear this call, it is because a deeper part of you has called it to you as a way by which you remember that these things are already contained within you. The way of transformation is the way of assuming responsibility for time, for each and every moment of it. For time is not a prison for you. It is that which flows out of your very consciousness, and there is never a place or a time. Never a place or a time which is more conducive to the way of transformation than the place in which you are and the time that is now. That's why so often in these lessons, Yeshua begins with the phrase, now we begin. In each new present now, there's a new beginning. Each new moment. Now we begin. So that paragraph jumps out at me every time I read this, so I'm going to read it again. The way of transformation is the way of assuming responsibility for time, for each and every moment of it. Time is not a prison for you. Time is that which flows out of your very consciousness. And there is never a place or a time. The text repeats this. Never a place or a time which is more conducive to the way of transformation than the place in which you are and the time that is now. There is no one without privilege. There is no one who, by their station in life, as the world would see it, is limited from watering and cultivating and bringing forth the fruit that rests within their unlimited consciousness. There is no one who is a victim of the world they see. For the world they see truly occurs nowhere except within the field of their awareness, which we call consciousness or mind. The buildings, the automobiles you drive, the dollars in the bank, none of that is real. These are merely symbols of the quality of experience you have chosen to call to yourself as a temporary learning experience. Beloved friends, use time well and ask yourself the following. Am I fully committed to transforming my awareness from one who has been sleeping and perceiving myself as limited to the space and time dimension, or am I committed to truly hearing my brother's call to take up my cross and follow him. That's the question we're encouraged to ask. Ask yourself this, and use time well to ask yourself that frequently in various ways. The text goes on and says, that is, the cross of crucifixion, the heavy wooden cross that you've been carrying around that says, quote, well, I'm really struggling and trying to get to Christ in consciousness, but maybe if I just got rid of my husband, that would do it. Or perhaps if I moved to another location, that would do it. Maybe there's a spiritual technique out there that I haven't found yet in the smorgasbord that's available. Once I find it and start practicing it, then I can get on with it. Close quotes. That is not it. The text goes on to say, you are in this moment, you are in the holiest of temples. Your higher self, your true self, your capital S self, that's what you're in. You abide in the perfect moment for your transformation. Nothing limits you at all or at any time. The power of the freedom of choice is the essence of Christ. And the very power that you've been using to try to convince yourself of your limitations, your smallness, your lack of worthiness, that same energy is exactly the same power that I used to overcome death. There is no difference, except a wink of an eye, an intention, a commitment, a recognition. That is all. In reality, nothing is impossible to you. And nothing is unavailable to you. So, what is it that occurs in the consciousness that seems to create the blockage, the obstacle to love's presence? As you create a temporary perceived limitation, and you do this as a way to call to yourself a certain quality of experience, there is a tendency to fall into the trap of identifying yourself with the constraints that you have set up from your unlimited freedom in order to have a temporary learning experience. And then you just forget that it was a temporary learning experience, and you fall into the dream of thinking it's real. When in your consciousness you come to be identified with the boundaries or constraints, another way to think about this is the lines upon the canvas that you have freely chosen to draw. When you become identified with boundaries and constraints and ideas and identifications, you create an imprisonment. That imprisonment is actually a complete illusion. And in reality, your unlimited self, capital S self, goes on experiencing anything it wants throughout all dimensions of creation. Your belief that you are defined by lines you have drawn in the field of consciousness, or the pebbles that you have dropped into the still clear pool of your mind, and the ripples those pebbles have created, that is only you creates a constriction, a destiny, and a conflict. This is occurring nowhere in your being except in that part of you that is extended like a sunbeam from the sun into that which you call the space-time dimension. So take a breath and think about this. If you feel constrained in this dimension, it does not mean that you are constrained. It simply means that one tiny ray of light is temporarily having a certain kind of experience. If you trace that ray of light back to its source, you find something brighter than 10,000 of your suns, something far more vast than the sun that lights your physical universe, something so vast that out of it has come forth a multitude of universes. That's the light of your awareness. That's the light of your consciousness. That's the light of your true self. That light of your soul, pure spirit, remains undefiled and unlimited. That tiny ray of light can become aware of the whole. And that is the process of awakening. It doesn't really change anything at all. Since you begin to become identified, not with the tiny little ray that is having a temporary experience, but you understand that your true identity is the field out of which that very power to experience the time-space dimension is coming forth. Now, how can you move from all of your thoughts and your really literally obsessive, compulsive thoughts over and over again? I get up in the morning and I have to do this and I have to do that. How can I? And then whatever follows that, where did that come from? Where does this thing that I want to do come from? Is it coming from the trivialities that have been dumped into my intellect, my conscious logical mind, from my family, from my culture, from my learning language, from my sense of what's appropriate in my sexuality and in my finances and in my social skills and in the way I hold a fork when I'm eating a meal and whether or not I say please or thank you or excuse me? Well, what are these thoughts that are regulating what I think I need to do or have to do or want to do? Am I willing to question that at a fundamental level? Over and over again, asking to be shown something different. The way of transformation says very clearly, we have to, if we want something to be different, we have to be willing to engage our mind energy moment to moment in our lives differently than we have prior to this. We can't continue to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. How can you go about your day differently? Well, here's an idea. Michael Rice has his tools called Purpose, Personal Power, and Commitment Lecture, and the tool that comes with that is my secondary purpose worksheet. How do I get to approach what I'm doing in my life differently? Maybe I go and I download that off of the whyagain.org website, and I decide I'm going to create for myself a secondary purpose, and I'm going to figure out what are the things I naturally am good at and what are the things I absolutely love to do. And through my filter and my culture and my life experience, what do I think needs to happen for the world to become a perfect place? And then I choose several things I'm naturally good at doing and combine it with several things that I absolutely love to do, regardless of whether or not I can make any money for it. And I formulate a way to say, I'm going to use the things I'm naturally good at doing and do some of the things I absolutely love to do as a way of helping the world become this better place, this perfect place. And then I'm going to use that tool every morning and several times a day whenever I'm faced with a thought about spending any considerable amount of my time, intelligence, money, or energy, and make sure that it is at least not conflicting with and hopefully is in direct alignment with that secondary purpose. And if it is in alignment with it, I rush to do it. And if it's not in alignment with it, but it really wouldn't hinder it, my secondary purpose, then I think about it before I do it. It's not like I don't do anything just for fun and I don't have any downtime. But if it's in any way going to prevent me from pursuing or taking a significant amount of time, intelligence, money, or energy away from my secondary purpose, I simply choose not to do it because I'm learning as I go the benefits to my life experience when I follow my secondary purpose. That's something that is available. It's another tool. It's available absolutely free on whyagain.org. And everyone I know who's taken a look at that and actually worked that exercise has been very, very happy they did. They've gotten tremendous benefit in their life by deciding to create a secondary purpose and choosing to use it as the focus for their energy, for their productive, constructive energy in their life. That's another way to take a look at combining the tools that Michael and Jeannie offer on whyagain.org and this work we're doing with the Way of Mastery. I have to find a way to change what I've been doing if I want anything to be different. So Guy Finley recommends, here's something different. Learn to be happy in this moment with whatever you have right now. And then from that space of being happy, then when you do things, then when you spend energy, you get a different level of result. You have more energy to bring to that expenditure of energy or that pursuit. And the primary thing that they're calling us to here in the first lesson 13 from the Way of Mastery, or the first lesson in the Way of Transformation, is to wake up and realize how often we're basically walking around like zombies, like little robots, like little wind-up toys, going through our lives the same way, having the same irritations and the same judgments of other people. Walking around blinded by the culture and the five senses so that we don't even get to perceive that everyone we interact with is a being of brilliance and light, just like we are. And that we wake up to the fact that we could choose in each new present moment to be more awake and aware, to experience the process that we are engaged in of creating our experience of life moment to moment, to become conscious about that process. So that's what we're being offered. That's what we're being called to. That's what we're being invited to with this work. And I'm going to stop reading there for today and leave some time for comments or questions. 563-999-3581. How is it striking you to be spoken to, as this lesson says, more directly, a lot less energy given to any thought about our personal dramas and traumas, and it's calling us to action. It's calling us to say, look, if you want something to be different, you have to be different. You have to use time wisely, moment to moment, because in each moment, your choice of how you focus your creative energy, your mind energy, is what's creating your experience of life. And begin in these very basic ways. Everywhere you go, everything you do, whether it's a trip to the grocery store or walking in your neighborhood, to be conscious and awake and aware in that moment that every time you judge, you've moved yourself further away from where you said you wanted to be. Every time you've judged, you've made the cells in your body act up and quit functioning properly. Every time you judge, you've moved away from what you say you want, which is love and gratitude and allowance and surrender, to be taught by life, to be taught by the great comforter or Holy Spirit, how to interact with the energies around you that maybe 2, 3, 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago, you didn't even know were there. How can you open up to an experience of life that's deeper and broader than anything you had before? If you ask how that can happen, you will be shown. This is what they said in previous lessons. If you ask, help will come. You know, this is that ancient wisdom about knock and it shall be opened. Ask and you shall receive. This is that thing from lesson 12 where it said, if you are feeling a fear, but you realize you've got to take an action, call for help. Call to these disembodied spirits, these consciousnesses that are all around you, and say, I want assistance. I know you're there. I know you'll come if I ask. And so I'm declaring it now. The exact quote is on page 150, and it says, legions of angels and masters and friends whose number is infinite beyond comprehension, you who are sent directly of the Creator to assist me over the ditch, get over here now, because I declare it and I receive it, and therefore it is. Ask for help when you're feeling anxious. Ask for help when you're feeling stuck and confused or angry, and help will come. One of the things that happens in that moment is you pull yourself out of the robotic repetition of your previous experience, of your reactions, which means to act again as you did before. When you experience road rage, when you experience irritation, as we said, if somebody's in the grocery store aisle where you want to be and they're not moving as fast as you think they should, or maybe they've got, you know, 23 items in the 15-item aisle and you decide that it's appropriate to have a response of anger. Well, if you do that without thinking about the silliness of it, you're just reenacting the robotic, mechanical, unproductive pattern that you've done hundreds of thousands of times before. And the way of transformation is calling us to step out of that. Step into conscious awareness of how we're using our time, intelligence, money, and energy in each new present moment, and choose again. Choose to ask to be shown. Choose to see our brothers and sisters as beings of brilliance and light just like us. Ask for guidance and assistance, patience, understanding, a different filter through which to look at life, so that your experience of life becomes transformed. That's the way of transformation. I can't transform something if I won't change the way I'm spending my time, intelligence, money, and energy. So that's what we're being asked to do. That's what we're being invited to do. That's what we're being shown how to do it more easily and productively with these different exercises. And we thank everyone for being here. We've reached the end of our first hour. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Appreciate you. Appreciate the readings, too.
You're very welcome and deserving. Have a wonderful show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Tuesday, June the 7th, 2022, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And while we're waiting on Michael to get dialed in, excuse me just a second. Had to cough there. Didn't want to do that in your ear. A couple things have been added to the website. If you click on schedules or go down to events, either one, you will find a free 3-hour Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop. If you click on that, you'll have all the information for how to sign in. Excuse me. It's going to be this Saturday from 2 to 5 o'clock. Now, yes, we are also having the monthly Mind Shifters meeting on Saturday, and that starts at 11. Pardon me. Take a drink and see if that helps any. Okay, so Saturday the 11th, we will have the Mind Shifters meeting. It starts at 11. It's a small group, and it usually only lasts 2 or 3 hours, so it should finish up prior to the 2 o'clock meeting. And that's going to be by Zoom, or if you join, there's a group on Facebook called the Marriage Support Group. It's run by a gentleman named Tim Kellis, and they are presenting Michael on Saturday to do a 3-hour Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop. The flyer and all the information, how to get on the Zoom link. You can either go on Facebook and join the Marriage Support Group and watch the workshop on Facebook Live, or you can just use the Zoom link and join us on Zoom. So there's two ways that you can join us on Saturday, and we invite you to join us and be there. But that is under schedule. It's also under event. It's also under flyers and publicity. So there's several places that you can find all that information and get the link to the flyer. So that is new. You can look around on Why Is This Happening to Me Again. We've changed a few things, added a few things. I am in the process. I've spent about an hour with India this morning, and I'm scheduled to be with him again tomorrow. So we've made changes for the Android, and he will submit that to Google. And tomorrow we're going to make the changes on the iPhone and get that submitted to Apple. So those will be coming. It's just a few little glitches that weren't working, like for some reason the link to the Rose and the Butterfly story started going to an error page. So we've corrected that, and then there's just a couple other little things that we have worked on to fix. So put the app to work. If you find anything, drop me a line. It probably won't get in this edition, but if you find something that's not working in the app, drop me a line at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and let me know, and we'll get it on the next go-round. Trying to keep it all up to date and keeping it operating and useful for you. And so I'm going to welcome Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. The technology process just never ends, does it? I mean, I can't count how many hours you put into getting that app to a place where it'd be functional. So pretty awesome.
And I offer thanks to our technician in India, too. I mean, he's working from home doing because of the time difference. You know, when he's working with me at 10 o'clock in the morning, it's 9 o'clock at night for him. If I get up while he's at work, then I have to get up at 5 in the morning. So one or the other of us is working on our own time to try to get this done. And he's just super helpful, and I'm thankful for him as well.
For sure. And I'm thankful for the earth. I was just out before the show started watering the garden, and I don't know if you've looked, sweetie, but our plum tomatoes are about a little bigger than an inch around now, or long, and our Brussels sprouts are about a half inch in diameter. They've just popped overnight. Pretty cool. More food from the garden. Yay, start growing real food. Real food grows in soil, not dirt. Most of what you buy in a grocery store is grown in dirt. It's not real food. So just a little plug there for start a garden. And what's on my mind today, I was talking to someone yesterday who's been around this work for several years and was going through a lot of symptoms. Actually, before I go into that, let me answer the question we have. Jeannie had given me a question that someone sent through the app. And thanks for the question, Phil. Does anyone know where to find the pronunciation, how to pronounce each beatitude in Aramaic, on which each word literally translates as? And first of all, on the literal idea, There are right brain languages and there are left brain languages. Left brain, you know, it'd be like mathematics. Everything's precise. Everything is exact and singular and boom, 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 boom. A equals B equals C equals D, whatever. Right brain languages, not quite the same. The right brain is the intuitive side of the function of this mind. It functions differently than linear. So I would never say that you could take any word from the Aramaic language and say its meaning is literal, because there are nuances in the right brain approach that leave room for a very broad understanding of a word. And so if you're looking for literal, what does this letter by letter mean? You're not going to find it in the Aramaic language. It just isn't a literal left brain language. And if you open yourself to it, there will be insight and guidance that comes that's beyond anything the left brain could ever give you. That said, if you go to our website, whyagain.org, and you go to the products page, you'll see a book called Enlightenment. Enlightenment is a book that we've published from our translation work, 25 of the World's Top Aramaicists, worked back in the early to mid-70s, working to establish the first century meaning of these Aramaic words. It was a very detailed process for doing that. In fact, the translation work was guided by a former partner, Dugald, who was an attorney. Bless his heart. He's passed now. Looking over at his picture right now, just inviting Dan to be with us and guide us. The right brain is what receives guidance as opposed to the left brain that wants its linear ideas. But as an attorney, he used the rules of evidence as put forward in the courtroom for determining the veracity of testimony. So everything that came in from the translator was kind of considered as testimony. And if it passed the rules of evidence, then it entered into the testimony. And then once the translator agreed on the meaning of a word, and Dan would send translations out to 25 translators, he'd get them back. And if there were conflicts, he would send it back out again and say, nope, something's not right with this. And so translator would feed the information back. Does it match? No. Then it goes back out again. And just by way of a story that I, you know, like to tell, and it was fun to be a part of, to Dan share this story. He had a gentleman in Chicago that he worked with who was, what would be the equivalent? His name was Marsh Schumann. And he would be the equivalent of the Pope of the Church of the East, you know, where the Roman pontiff is. Well, this guy would be the equivalent, and because of the conflicts in the Middle East, he ended up in Chicago. Dan used to describe Marsh Schumann as being older than God, and he would go and see him, and this gentleman who was older than God still drove around Chicago and apparently drove like a madman. Dan would lovingly tell stories about, you know, his harrowing journeys through the streets of Chicago with Marsh Schumann. But there was one particular word they were having a problem with the translators. And there was one very well-respected translator named Shapley. And Dan sent out to the translators the word neighbor and got back two different responses. Most of the translators sent back a translation of the word neighbor is a mental word, not a physical word. But Shapley brought it forward as, you know, this is the guy who lives down the block from you type of meaning. In contraindication of what everybody else was saying. So Dan describes going to see Marsh Schumann, you know, on one of his trips to Chicago and bringing this word neighbor to him. And I can still see in my mind's eye Dan kind of mimicking Marsh Human as he waved off the idea of it being a physical word, that it was about the guy down the block, the physical neighbor. And he sort of waves his hand to mimic Marsh Human. He says, oh, I know what's got Shapley confused. He's reading those new dictionaries that they wrote in the 6th century. So Marsh Human's giving a correction. In its origins, the word neighbor is a mental word and, in fact, means anybody that you think about. Now, we're told that by the Greeks that we were told to love our neighbor as ourselves and love God, and that's totally and completely an errant translation. No such instruction was ever given. Actually, we were told to have a condition in our minds when we think of the Creator, when we think of neighbor. And that then means anybody that you think about, that you maintain a condition called rachma in your mind. And rachma, it turns out, and this is something we checked out, there's a community in California who is still, you know, native Aramaic-speaking peoples. And I was out there, we were doing getting high-resolution images made of the manuscript. And we went to visit with these folks, and they were... One of the questions we asked them was this word rachma. And what they shared was that the actual meaning of the word had been lost to history. Nobody knew. So here's Yeshua saying, here is the most important thing, and nobody knows what the word means. What they did share was that their tradition said, although the meaning had been lost, that it the most precious jewel, as in, you know, a diamond or a ruby, it was the most precious jewel you could possess. So pretty important. Well, it turns out, as we worked with and worked with and worked with the translation, the word rachma represents a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that does two things. One, it's the gateway that brings human life, love, into the human mind. So what's most important to human life when they ask Yeshua? He answers, there is a filter in the frontal lobes of your brain that when active allows the entryway of your created essence love into your body-mind unit. And while that gateway is active, it will inhibit your mind from using any form of hostility or fear-based intentions as a resource for establishing the goals that drive perception in your mind. So, pretty important piece of information to have been lost. So, we need to have this condition in our mind so that we function as human beings, because if the alternative filters to rachma, there are three filters over intentions in the frontal lobes of the brain, the alternative filters are hostility and fear. And hostility or fear serve up intentions keyed to negativity and destruction, where keyed to when rachma is active, it serves up intentions keyed to love. Turns out, as we uncover these Aramaic gems, that goals are important because goals are the drivers for perception. And if goals are based in negativity or destruction, then perception is going to lead us to do hostile and destructive things. So if you want to keep a human life, you have to maintain this condition, this gateway open, rachma, and active. So profoundly powerful. So when you come to understanding how these translation processes worked, then you really want to access the information directly. And what we have published so far from the Kabor's manuscript. And unfortunately, back in the 70s, the project ran out of money, and there's been no translation work done since we don't know what we don't know from the manuscript. But what we have published so far is in a book called Enlightenment. You can order it from our product page on our website. The book's called Enlightenment. And the very question that you ask whenever somebody purchases that book, I always suggest that they sit down with a pen and paper and longhand translate the Beatitudes from Matthew 5 using the dictionary in the back of the book. So the way that the book is laid out is there are some select passages from the New Testament, and it's in a kind of the format of the King James Version, and the key words in Aramaic are left in brackets in that translation work. So you can take this key word and go back to the dictionary and longhand write out your own definitions. It's powerful. And I remember, and this goes back, 35 years ago, maybe more, that I took that project on of writing it out longhand using that dictionary. And it was the second time that I did it. I did it once and I was like, oh, this is impactful. And then I did it again. It was a short time later. I was guided to do it again. And it was then that I realized that the Beatitudes are not what the Greeks taught us. They're not a nice philosophy. The Beatitudes are a set of instructions for achieving a certain state of mind. The first word in each of the Beatitudes, the Greeks tell us it's blessed are they, nothing to do with blessed are they. Although you can see when you understand the Aramaic how they made that leap. Not having the Aramaic brain cells, you can see how they made the leap to blessed are they, like there's some sort of external force that's going to bless you if you do something. But the word that they translated as blessed are they in Aramaic is tuvehun. Tuvehun is a three-part word. Three different concepts in one word. A tuv is an attitude of mind or a neural structure, a structure in the mind. And the word tuvehun more properly translated would be a latent or an unconscious neural structure implanted in you by the Creator to guide you to happiness and well-being becomes your conscious possession. So this attitude of mind that's been relegated to the unconscious by our hostility and fear-based cultures will come back into activity if you follow the instructions in the Beatitudes. And the Beatitudes are a set of instructions for doing that. I suspect, seeing as how I'm speaking about this, Jeannie has probably already pasted in the links. We did actually almost a whole week of a conversation not long ago on the Beatitudes. There's a gentleman who had really picked up on that and from the work he did at Heartland, really tapped in, following Mark, to the Beatitudes and spent time with them. And so we set up and had a series of radio shows where we talked about that. And so you can get a deeper listen to the Beatitudes by going to the archives, or I assume probably Jeannie's already got a link in the notes for today. So you can tap into and do that, but get a copy of the Enlightenment book. There's it's not a huge book. It's small, but there's a dictionary. There's an explanation about the manuscript, and then there are these select passages. Take them and start writing. Put your pen to the paper and watch how the right brain opens and how things that you can't say in English, part of your understanding. Now, you go back to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, and Aramaic-speaking peoples asked him a question of his Aramaic mind, and he says, there's so many things I would say to you, but you can't hear them yet. In other words, you're stuck in your left brain, linear, you want A, B, C, D, E, and the universe doesn't work like A, B, C, D. Oh, it's precise, it's precision, but the creative function is from the right brain. And so as you start to develop the brain cells for that deeper level and you activate what Yeshua understood as and explained as a neural structure in you that was literally implanted to guide you to happiness and well-being. The guidance system is there. It's just been subverted in our hostility and fear-based world, and the Beatitudes explain how to reverse that so that the underlying energetic motion, you know, if you talk to the psychologist today, they'll tell you that 90, perhaps 95, maybe as much as 98% of our mental activity is unconscious. Why is that? Because for centuries we've been taught to live in denial and blame. You made me mad. And when we live in denial, we create this unconscious mind. We create this unnatural state of mind where our own mental processes are hidden from us. And when we come from unconscious mental processes, life gets crazy. Because of the unresolved hatreds and angers and rages and guilts and fears and traumas that overlie the guidance system that was designed for us. Now, as I say, it was the second time that I'm writing these out long, and it was just like, oh my God, this isn't a nice philosophy. This is a set of instructions for how to achieve a true human life, how to activate this neural structure and realize that the guidance comes from within you. It's not out there somewhere. You know, much as Yeshua said, and this does come through in the Greek, you know, if somebody tells you the kingdom is over there or over there or over there, believe them not, for it is here and it is now and it is within you. And by the way, the term, the community of heaven in Aramaic, is more properly translated as the community of love. Not someplace off in the sky, not some afterlife promise, but a place that you were designed to live here and now. You hear so many people who bought this Greek mythology garbage, and they're waiting to go off to heaven when they die. Of course, nobody comes back to say, that wasn't exactly it. But in the actual teachings of Yeshua, he's saying, there is a state that you can achieve here and now, and you can live in that state. It was called in the Beatitudes a heavenly estate. And it came from, you know, the first Beatitude. If we look at the Greek translations, it tells us that we're supposed to be poor in spirit. Now, Yeshua 2,000 years ago tells you that, you know, you can even deny me, but don't deny that spirit that I'm here to connect you with. Connect with it. If you deny it, you're in trouble. And so now, here we have the Greeks telling us that we're going to be blessed if we are poor in what Yeshua said he came to connect us with. How silly is that? How inside out, backward, upside down, and insane is that? And more properly translated, that passage would say, Tuvehun, a latent neural structure implanted by the Creator to guide you to happiness and well-being, becomes your conscious possession, you whose home is in the eternal forces from God, for yours is a heavenly estate. In other words, do you live in your mind? Do you live in your ABC linear left brain? To heal, you got to be out of your mind. Sooner or later, you got to be willing to be out of your mind. And that leads us right into what I was going to talk about earlier about the healing process. I was talking to someone yesterday who was experiencing, and if you start to do this work and you say to yourself, well, you know, I haven't had a cold in 15 years. Well, if you haven't had a cold in 15 years, one of two things is true. You are on track and you're doing the right stuff and you are rocking. Or if you've been eating the sad diet and thinking the way of the hostility and fear-based mind, and your system is so shut down and suppressed that you couldn't process through energetic patterns that your structure is holding on to that don't belong there. People who are in that condition, when they start to do this work, start to experience all kinds of symptoms. And because we live in a culture that tells us symptoms are disease, people tend to get stuck in, oh my God, I have a disease. I better go run, find myself somebody to give me some pills to shut down this disease. It's interesting, there's an article just recently in the British Journal of Medicine, and this is a journal that's over 100 years old. It's one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. Take a look at the article. And what they're saying is that this new thing called evidence-based medicine, by and large, in this culture, is a fraud. And it's a fraud, you know, it's not accusing specific doctors who work in evidence-based medicine, but what they're acknowledging is that corporate interests And the way research money works and the way the pharmaceutical industry makes money from drugs, the whole system has become so dishonest and so fraught with fraud that you can't count on it anymore. And, you know, I mean, look it up, British Journal of Medicine, evidence-based medicine. Put that in a search engine and read the article. Take you about 20 minutes. There's a good review of it. There's a fellow named Dr. John Campbell, who's actually a British nursing professor in a university in Britain. He does a lot of really good stuff. And if you look for, put Campbell in that search engine, he does an explanation of this article. And it's, I mean, it's just so enlightening to recognize that this pharmaceutical industry that we've been taught is, you know, world-renowned and to be trusted. I mean, do some research. And I don't have in my mind right offhand, I don't have the numbers, but, you know, the top five pharmaceutical companies, if you look, each of them has been fined millions and millions and millions and more millions of dollars for fraud and criminal activity in promoting drugs, in marketing drugs, in developing drugs, in falsifying research, millions of dollars. And the British Medical Journal is acknowledging that this is destroying medicine. You know, why do we live in a country that literally, if I remember the numbers correctly, we spend 60% more on disease care in this country than literally any one of the other, I think it's 38 developed countries that kind of work together as a group. We spend 60% more than any other country, and our outcomes like infant mortality, something like number 35, maternal mortality is outrageous. The statistics, the disease statistics, we are so far down the ladder. I mean, we are behind countries you think of as primitive in terms of health outcomes. And the British Medical Journal is explaining exactly why that's true and why people need to take charge of their own health and become aware of what's going on, the fraud, the way that research is done only to produce drugs that they can hook people on for life and make an income that they're not interested in healing. There's very little or no research that's done toward healing. It's all done toward treatment so we can hand somebody a pill that they'll buy from them for life. Each person, and I've said this for decades now, needs to learn to become their own healthcare provider. Primary healthcare provider. You've got to know what you need to do and be careful where you go, because the number three cause of death in America is medicine. The number three cause of death in America is properly prescribed medication. Put that word properly in brackets. It's just something, you know, most people don't even suspect. When you start looking, it's important. So the danger of starting to do your work and recognizing that you're going to become symptomatic is when you become symptomatic that you run out and get a pill to shut down your symptoms. And the way that pills shut down symptoms is they weaken the system. They create a toxic load that stops the body from processing what needs to be processed. So if you're living the sad diet, if you've got hostility and fear going on and conflict in your relationships and financial difficulties and stress, and you haven't had a cold in 15 years, my offering is you're in deep doo-doo. You're in deep trouble. Because the structure, if it's vital enough, is designed to process out what doesn't belong. So be aware of that. And when you start to do this work, understand the healing process. I started this conversation out saying I had spoken with someone who was very symptomatic. They'd done this work for years. And as I quizzed them, what we established was she was not in the disease process. Yes, she had all kinds of symptoms going on, But what was happening was she had hit a new level of vitality and was processing what her body needed to process. So let's do a basic explanation of that. Let's imagine that we have a vitality meter. And the vitality meter goes from 1 to 10. If you're at a 1, man, you are low. It's like hard to get out of bed in the morning. If you're at a 10, you are rocking. You fly out of bed in the morning. You don't need caffeine. You don't need fixes. You don't need sugar. You don't need junk food. You are alive and vital. Your mind shoots on all cylinders. Your physiology goes, and you rock. Now, let's imagine that we've got somebody so that's a level 10. But let's imagine we've got somebody that's a level 5 vitality. And they have a level 7 toxic load that they're carrying. Maybe it's a poison that they took on in childhood or, you know, at some point. Maybe it's an emotional toxin, something that maybe has been going on for generations in the bloodline. Maybe it's a traumatic experience somebody had as a child. But its toxicity level is 7. Now, here's what the structure does. Here's what the energy system does. If I'm at a level 5 vitality, I have a level 7 toxin, my body says my energy system says I'm going to wall this off. I'm going to put some protection around it so that we can keep it in abeyance and it doesn't destroy us. Now, let's say, you know, maybe that toxic load relates to rage. And somebody, you know, notices they go through their lives and, you know, I'm driving down the road and somebody does something stupid and here I am in a rage and somebody does this and somebody does that or I do something that's I consider silly and I start raging at myself, start telling myself how stupid I am or whatever. That level 7 toxin, somebody says, oh, I want to be through with that. I want to finish that. I want to get done with that. I want to get rid of that. Please, God, take that away from me. I want to be finished with it. But, excuse me, no, don't ask me to eat real food. No, I like my Mickey D's. I like my scotch in the evenings. I like my beer at lunch. You know, you want me to eat actual food. Like, you want me to take, like, a strawberry from the garden and eat that rather than that strawberry jam that's half sugar and half hydrogenated fat, that one that I like? You want me to actually eat an almond rather than a peanut that's got toxic molds because it hasn't been handled properly and it was put in a jar with a ton of sugar and hydrogenated oils? Then that's what I like to spread on my bread in the morning. You want me to eat actual almond butter, something that has actual natural oils and is actually nutrition for me? No, forget it. I want my sugar jam and my hydrogenated fat peanut butter. Well, you just locked your vitality down to a level where there are things your structure needs to process and it can't do it. So when you start to do this work, which means you're doing more of the right things, you're starting to look at your nutrition. You may be discarding that fifth of scotch every other evening and you're replacing it with some water. You're starting to shift your dietary habits. You're working more in the arena of cultivating your relationship with love, of strengthening the awareness of yourself and the people around you as the presence of love. You're sitting down on a daily basis and you're doing a worksheet or two or three or four or five and you're processing through those energetic patterns. And all of a sudden, as a result of doing that, you start building. You go from a level 5 vitality to a 6 and you start to get up in the morning and go, you know, I really don't need that cup of coffee. I'm feeling pretty good. And I'm talking from experience here. I used to be in the restaurant business, and I used to do 2 pots of coffee a day. You couldn't stuff coffee down my throat for love nor money, and I haven't had a cup in, I don't know, I used to take a little sip off of Jeannie's when she drank it, and she hasn't drank it for years now. But I can remember a time when I couldn't drag myself out of bed without a cup of coffee. Artificial energy, toxic, deadly. Actually, do some research. I think it was ABC or NBC, one of the major news outlets, You can go to YouTube and just type in, I think it was ABC, reporter, coffee, and MRI. And there's a woman that goes to a doctor. She's a reporter, and they're doing a report on coffee. And she talks to the doctor. She's been instructed. She doesn't have any coffee. And they do an MRI on her. And then they have her drink one cup of coffee, and they do another MRI. I mean, they're sitting there right then and there. And the doctor reads the second MRI, and guess what? The blood flow to her brain, he informs her, has been cut by a full 40%. That's 40% blood flow to the brain stopped from one cup of coffee in the morning. Now, I know there's research out there that says coffee's good for you and coffee does this for you and does, but excuse me, go read the article in the British Medical Journal and then go find out who financed those studies, quote-unquote studies. One cup of coffee, 40% restriction, right there on the MRI. So if you start to drop those habits and strengthen, then you get to a level 7 vitality, and you go, wow, I wake up in the morning, man, I feel so good. This is awesome. And then, you know, maybe that day you do a particularly meaningful piece of work and you let go of a big one. Like there is a load off your back. You say, man, I feel like I just took a 10-ton weight off my shoulders. And now you're at a level 7.5 vitality. Remember that level 7 toxicity we talked about? When you hit that level 7 vitality, I mean, you go to bed that night and you feel so good. Man, I am rocking, flying high. You go to sleep. You get up in the morning and you wonder if anybody got the number of the Mack truck that went through your room during the night because you are lower than a snake's belly. And I mean this quite literally, physically, mentally, emotionally, you're in the pit. It's like, what the hell happened to me? I've been doing the right things. Yep, that's the reason this has happened to you. And you want that to happen to you. That is absolutely 1,000% desirable because that level 7 toxin, wherever it's stored, if it's stored in your heart, guess what? 30 years down the road, it's probably going to show up as a heart attack. If it's stored in your brain, guess what? 30 years down the road, it's probably going to show up as a stroke. If it's stored in your blood marrow, guess what? It's probably going to show up as blood cancer. So sooner or later, you got to pay the piper. It's either going to come out as a disease or it's going to come out as symptoms. When you become symptomatic, when you recognize, when you understand the process and you recognize that you're in a symptomatic condition because you've hit a new level of vitality, and actually there are a couple of questions you ask yourself, four different things that will tell you when you become symptomatic. If you start doing this work and you become symptomatic, there are four questions to ask yourself to establish that these are symptoms in process. The first question you ask yourself is, one, have I been doing more and more of the right things? Nutritionally, mentally, emotionally, relationship. Two, just before these symptoms hit, had I hit a new level of vitality? Three, what's happening with my elimination? In a disease process, there is a tendency for there to be a restriction in elimination. And we're talking about the output of all of the eliminative organs. We're talking about the bowel, the urinary tract, the skin, the mucous membranes, the sinuses, the lungs. There will tend to be an increase in the output when you go into a new level of vitality. And so, yeah, you could say, I haven't had a cold in 15 years, and all of a sudden I've got the quote-unquote flu, and man, my lungs are just shooting all this stuff out every time I cough. Well, if you've been doing the right things, you're at a new level of vitality, your vitality's increased, and there's a fourth question we'll come up with. You are in hog heaven. You are on the high side of luck because now your structures by the left to start to process out that load. And guess what? That last hawk of phlegm is liable to be what was going to be the beginning of the cancer cells in your lungs. So it's desirable to go into a healing process. The fourth question that will verify for you that you're in a healing process rather than a disease process is that you will find when you're under stress, you crave the drug that you use to shut down those symptoms initially. So let's say, for instance, we've got the fellow who, you know, he's been on the wagon for 30 years. He's so proud. He got his chip just last night for his 30 years of sobriety. And he's so excited. And he shares with everyone. All his friends are there applauding him and hooray and all kinds of love being sent in his direction, a whole new level of vitality. And what happens? Boom, healing process. It opens. And he falls off the wagon. Why did he fall off the wagon? Because 30 years ago, when he would use a fifth of scotch to shut down whatever this pain was, he's now reached a level of vitality where he can reopen that. If he understands that his craving after 30 years for a shot of scotch that he hasn't touched in 30 years is coming from the fact that this old toxicity and this old alcohol habit energetically is now opening to be cleared out of his structure. He's freeing himself of that dis-ease energy, but if not in awareness and there's that overwhelming craving for alcohol just like 30 years ago, that's when somebody falls off the wagon. Our whole culture is a drug culture, and I'm not talking even about the illegal or the legal drugs. I'm not talking about the insanity that now pot is going to become available to every young person coming up the tubes. You know, let's destroy their brains. We need to wake up to what we're doing to ourselves. In any event, just to remember those four questions. Have I hit a new level of vitality? I've been doing the right things. My elimination is working, and I'm craving that old drug. I now know for sure that these symptoms are healing in process. And what I want to do is I want to lay on the cosmic grease. And cosmic grease is what I call willingness. I'm going to stand in a space of willingness to process through these energetic patterns that are not Dr. Feelgood, that are very traumatic. And it might go right back. I may have memories surface of things that happened to my great-great-grandfather. In fact, Jeannie, it might be a good idea to put the link in the notes today just for a demonstration of that, of the phone call. We were doing the codependence to interdependence intensive online, and Magda called in and shared how, and she had done the responsibility communication in the context of the codependence intensive, and how that opened. You know, we had given her an assignment. She was having some literally physiological challenges with her heart, and her assignment in the intensive was to start to inquire of her ancestors about the health of their hearts. And she called into the show and shared, and I know that when she shared it during the intensive, it left me in tears. And when she called back into the radio show and shared that she had a whole conversation that opened up with her grandfather who had passed, or it might have been her grandfather. Anyway, and he shared how they had come over from Europe, were broken, starving in Europe, and thought they were coming to the land of milk and honey, and found themselves just as broken, starving, in fact, having to dig a hole in the ground and create a cave to have a place to live, and not knowing if the gardens were going to produce and if they'd have enough food for their kids, and how he raged and how he abused his wife and his children. And her conversation with him, I mean, it was just monumental. The resolution that took place and the power of her sharing that. And that's the kind of stuff that has to come up to be processed out of this energy system. Elsewise, it tends to create dis-ease processes in tissue that we call physical diseases. Now, my offering is there's no such thing as a physical disease. Now, most everybody would say, oh, come on, Michael, no, that's just a stupid thing to say. There's no physical disease. Well, you know, maybe you know better than Einstein, but let's listen to Einstein and what he had to say on the topic. Here's what he said. Quote, on such things as matter, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy, energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. If there is no matter, then there is no material disease. Our eye makes it look like matter, but in fact, if we could see, if we could actually see when we look at what we call a body at another level of energy, another level of vibration, we know that radio waves exist. We can't see them. But if we could see on that level, we'd see that this whirring mass of electrons, protons, neutrons, and light, and this whirring energy system, if there were dis-ease, disintegrative energies in the energy system, then the energy system would be in a state of degeneration. And wherever that energy was stored, the organs involved would start to reflect as diseased organs. And their appearance would be distorted by the presence of the dis-ease energy in those particular cells and in those particular organs. Forgiveness, a la first century Aramaic, the tool that we're primarily here to share with you, is how to access on an energetic level those energy patterns that never belonged within your structure. How to process through them. And when you decide to step up and use the tools, and each time you hit a new level of vitality, there are going to be symptoms that will express on a physical, mental, and emotional level. Remember the willingness. Remember not to jump out and take a pill because you're symptomatic. Ask yourself first, have I been doing more of the right things? Had I hit a new level of vitality? Is my elimination working better? And am I craving those old drugs? If your answer is yes, then you're in a healing process. You're not in a disease process. And on a physical level, healing looks like any kind of physical symptom you've ever had and low energy. That's what healing looks like. On a mental level, healing looks like any kind of negative thought you've ever had and confusion. Yes, mass confusion is part of the healing process. On an emotional level, healing looks like any kind of negative feeling you've ever had and depression. And that's where you want to be aware, continue to utilize the tools, and continue to open your structure to throw off what does not belong and to reconnect and reestablish your relationship with yourself as the active presence of love, as your true nature. So as you start doing the work, it can kind of fall into the divine forgettery when you become symptomatic, especially if those symptoms are severe. And they can become, I promise you will never face anything inside of you that you didn't bring with you to the work. And whatever you did bring, whether it's 10 generations old or happened to you as a child or happened yesterday, energetically, as you bring forward conscious, active, present love, the focal point of this work, and you learn to collapse perception that gives you access to the underlying energetic patterns held in the tissue structure, then healing happens. Otherwise, it's all symptom treatment. Nobody has ever been cured by a drug. There is no person who gets headaches because their body lacks aspirin. Aspirin, by the way, is salicylic acid, comes from white willow bark tree. But, you know, if you go and look, you'll find that there are hundreds of companies that make white willow bark herb from the white willow bark tree. But you know, there's one company that owns the word aspirin. What did they do? They took the white willow bark, salicylic acid, and I forget exactly the chemical bond, but they put an extra chemical in there to change it so it was no longer a natural molecule. It was now a man-made molecule, which meant it could be patented. And let me tell you that wars are fought over those patents. If you look at who was behind Hitler, it was a company called Bayer. Take a look. Do the research. That's who funded Hitler. You'll notice just recently, as a new president came into office, Bayer came into America. The same people that funded Hitler took over a company that made the most toxic chemicals of war that have ever been made on the planet. And guess what? That company now owns the majority of seeds, the patents, unnatural states of seeds on the planet. What do you suppose that's about if you start to get conscious of history and what's really going on in the world? It's time for us to wake up. Time for us to start to become aware. It's a very good interview by a gentleman named Rath, Dr. R-A-T-H. He's a German medical doctor. Put in a search engine. Actually, go to YouTube. Type in Rath, Bayer, Hitler. He outlines it all. Guess what it was all about? It was about forcing other governments to honor patents so they could collect money for these unnatural molecules that they owned. And these companies that own these unnatural molecules, and every drug is an unnatural molecule. There is no body that's ever been short of any drug that's ever been sold. You can't call it a drug unless it's an unnatural molecule and you can patent it. Just something to be aware of. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a place for them. No question. If you got symptoms going on that are life-threatening, there's no question they can save a life. But there's a difference between saving a life and healing. Treatment? Yep. Boy, the cat's meow. But my offering is any physician who does not offer healing along with treatment is guilty of malpractice. Yeah, if you need to do a treatment, have at it. But please do the healing work hand in hand with it if you really want to be healed and you really want to be whole. And ultimately, what you're going to need to bring the whole energy system into harmony is actual, real food that is grown in soil. There's an article I'm working on. Actually, it'll probably turn into a book called Healing from the Ground Up. If what you put in your mouth is not grown in soil, but rather is grown in dirt, you can't ever be healthy in the true sense of true human health. You can't grow food in dirt. And when you pour a gallon on every acre, or 10 gallons on every acre of glyphosate, and make sure everything in the soil is completely dead, you no longer have soil, you now have dirt. Food doesn't grow in dirt. That's why they have to use chemicals to make it look like food. Nutrition, the energy patterns that are needed to support this energy system are dead and gone. So, kind of cover the whole gamut here. This is called holy. In the ancient teachings, holy didn't mean get down on your knees and fold your hands. It meant you had to understand and be responsible for every level of your life. What do you put in your mouth? Where does it come from? Do you have anything to do with the soil? Do you do the work of forgiveness? Do you have any comprehension what it means to live as the active presence of love, as a true human being? Do you have any comprehension of that? Or is it just like, well, I was told, go get a job, make money. What's it really mean to be a human being? You want to know? Hold a newborn child. Tap into the essence of the newborn. And when you get to the essence of the newborn, you'll notice that it's love. And you'll notice that the newborn isn't loving you. The newborn simply is the fact of love. It's who and what we are. And there's work to be done in order to get out of the generational patterns. Can you look at that story of the Jews wandering in the desert for 40 years? Do you think they were really lost in a 35 square mile area in a hot, sandy place and couldn't find a way out for 40 years? I mean, that's silly. But that word desert does represent a state that many people are lost in all their lives, and it's called unconsciousness. What had to happen to get out of the desert into what was called the promised land? What had to happen to get out of the desert, the state of creating the same things over and over and over again? There's a book about this. You can download it free from our website. It's called Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Because those who create unconsciously, who are stuck in their own unconscious, their own desert, simply play the game over and over and over, and it's always somebody else to blame. You want to move out of that into the promised land? What had to happen? They said the old generation had to die off. Look at those passages in the scriptures. The old generation had to die off. Did that mean everybody in old physical bodies had to physically die? No. The root of the word generation is genare. It means cause. I described to you a few minutes ago what Magda touched into as a cause for what the trauma was in her heart. Generations back. And was able to process that and move through it. We each must develop the skill of doing that if we want to truly live a true, full human life. And my offering is that's what we're here to do. So I hope that fits and makes sense. And we got a few minutes for questions, Gina. Do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
We do have a hand up. So it's 904.
Great,
you're on the
hello.
Air. I think this is Dusty.
Well, aloha, everybody. Hope
aloha,
well.
Young man. Welcome. Haven't heard your sweet voice in a while.
Yes, and I've been meaning to call you about a song, but that's another topic because I know we're close on time, but you use the word willingness repeatedly.
Yes,
and
cosmic freeze.
It's a powerful word because it implies, first of all, that there's intention and a motivation. I mean, that's what it's going to take.
Yes.
Because most of the time, the problem for any and all of us is that to do that and to upgrade our human potential or whatever it is, we have to leave our comfort zone.
Yeah, you have to get out of Satan, actually. In Aramaic, the word Satan means the resister, one who misleads. It's not a dude with a red suit, tail, and pitchfork. The word Satan means the resister. You know, you tell the average person that they're responsible for their rage, they'll go, no, wait a minute. No, that's not true. This isn't my fault. Let me tell you about Charlie and or Bill or Harry or Mary, and they'll give you their mislead. And that's exactly what Satan is in Aramaic, and most people are trapped there most of their lives.
Okay, that's good to know.
But the Greeks came along and made it into this dude that's out there. The problem's somewhere out there, of course.
Right.
And willingness to move inside and look inside is profound.
Oh, yes. And a bunch of, I would say the majority of people I run into, if they are even cognizant of that, avoid it at all costs. And because growth doesn't happen without, you know, leaving your comfort zone and journeying into a brighter environment. And
right.
there's a word that I like, or a phrase in psychology, a cognitive dissonance, that
yes.
If somebody has a cherished belief, oh, you know, I've got more money than you, or whatever it is, cherished belief that's very limiting, no matter how much they're presented with something else that's you know, clear and documented and blah, 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 they won't believe it or accept it. In fact, I see people all the time, you just make up stuff out of whole cloth to avoid
yep.
at all costs the truth.
Well, to avoid the truth and to be able to justify their belief in whatever their current reality is. You know, if I need this piece, that piece of information to prove this to you, I'll just, as you say, I'll just make it up. Just make shit up. That's what people do in order to keep believing, to roll along the surface of belief rather than having to drop in and question themselves and confront whatever's inside.
Yeah, cheap way to go. And I would say to anybody who is facing their demons at any level, if you go for it, you're in a way, I'm just going to use a phrase, a spiritual warrior. You're a warrior of growth, because it takes a certain amount of, I don't know if I would use the word courage all the time, but it certainly takes motivation.
Takes guts, for sure.
Yeah. And so when those discomfort levels hit, don't jump ship.
You know? Willingness, cosmic grace.
Right.
Right
that
on,
very
friend.
Good what you, Yeah, and I love that whole monologue. That was beautiful. Thank you.
Sweet. Awesome. Well, we're down to the last minute or so, and Dusty, it's something about a piece of music. When we hang up, I'm going to dial you right back just to say hello. And everybody, thanks for joining us. Create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.